Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
"11 months ago, George Floyd's death ignited protests about racism and policing across the country and around the globe.
Enough is enough. The people marching in the streets are telling you enough is enough.
Millions saw the cell phone video of George Floyd dying with police officer Derek Chauvin's knee on his neck. But it was not until yesterday that a jury found Chauvin guilty on 3 counts, second-degree felony murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. George Floyd's family, including his brother Philonis, were at the courthouse to hear it.
Today, we are able to breathe again.
After months of anxiety, the verdict came as a relief to those who called for reform in the wake of George Floyd's death. But it's not the end of the story. The work to prevent future police killings of black and brown Americans continues. Here's George Floyd's cousin, Paris Stevens.
Change is here. And police are going to start to be held accountable. You know, it's not going to be swept up underneath the rug like it normally used to be.
I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point. This hour, what the verdict in the Derek Chauvin case means for the country and the struggle to reform policing in America. Joining us from Minneapolis is Nina Moyney, a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Nina, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what the reaction was there in Minneapolis to this verdict yesterday.
Well, Kimberly, as you can imagine, people have really been on pins and needles here for the past few weeks. And during the trial of Derek Chauvin, there was also another police killing of a black man. So there was just so much trauma, sadness, and just anxiety in the community. And as hundreds of people were gathered outside of the Hennepin County Courthouse awaiting this verdict, there was just anxiety. And then suddenly there was jubilation and joy and tears and just a very sudden shift. And then almost as soon as all of that happened, it appeared, at least to me, that the relief set in. And then everybody sort of took a breath and said, okay, now there's more work to be done. So to witness that is just very humbling, to witness people who wanted so bad for justice to be served, but who then know that this is a beginning point and that as exhausted as everybody may be, there is still more work to be done and everybody's got to organize and sort of regroup and keep going. So that's a lot of the message that we heard. We heard from Benjamin Crump, the civil attorney for the Floyd family, that this was justice won, you know, with just through a lot of pain. So it wasn't exactly the happiest day. And it wasn't exactly justice for everybody, but I heard a lot of people say this was a really historic moment and a really good starting point.
And Nina, you were saying that they were saying that this was just, as you said, a starting point. What does justice look like? And what does that, what kind of organizing did they say they want to do and see happen next?
Well, I think there are different levels, right? I mean, here in the state of Minnesota, we've been talking about police reform ever since George Floyd was killed back in May. And our state lawmakers did pass some laws that many lawmakers refer to as sort of a first step, things like banning a warrior-style training, but or banning chokeholds. But they're wanting to take that to the next level, many of the Democrats at the state legislature, many of the people who serve and the people of color and indigenous caucus in our state want to see more police reform happen at this point. And then we also know that at the federal level, President Biden has been talking about the George Floyd Police Accountability Act for many months now. So there are a lot of people who want this to be sort of a moment for change, but also feel like that with other sort of similar cases that we've seen over the years, those changes and those police reform measures haven't exactly been brought to the top of the list of priorities.
I see. And so, look, I think we know that the trauma that a lot of folks in the community have been talking about isn't simply going to dissipate after the verdict. And I think they also know that it's not just legislation that is going to change. Are you getting any sense from community members about how the culture of policing needs to change?
Well, that too, you know, is a discussion that's been happening here on the ground in Minneapolis since May when George Floyd was killed. And I think people don't recognize, if they don't live here, what a big part of this community that George Floyd has become. There are murals of him everywhere. There are photos of him, pictures of him in people's windows. So this isn't something that went away. It's almost like it's something that continued this entire time. So it's brought to the forefront a lot of conversations about the Minneapolis Police Department in particular. And right now there are different lawmakers, different city council members who are on different pages as to how do we begin to rebuild some of the trust that's been broken between community members and the police department. There are calls to defund the police department as it currently stands in favor of a different form of policing that they say is a more holistic form of policing. And then you have groups of people that say, hey, now, wait a minute, let's wait. You know, we have seen some record levels of crime in our city in the last year, as a lot of cities have with the pandemic and other factors. But there seems to be, for the last year, just a lot of a lack of consensus over how do we do this. So before this trial, you know, the governor brought in a really heightened sense of police presence and the National Guard, and we almost felt like it was sort of a militarized city in the way that people had never seen before. And a lot of that was because, as peaceful and as powerful as many of the protests were last May, we did experience looting and rioting. We lost an entire police precinct that burned down. So the sort of balance has become, how do we protect property and safety and stop any violence that may break out, while also mm-hmm. allowing people to express their First Amendment rights? So it's been a year, and all I can say is it doesn't seem very more clear how exactly changes will be brought about here in the state of Minnesota.
Well, Nina Moyney, reporter for Minnesota Public Radio, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Now I want to bring in another voice into the conversation. Vaughn Dickerson is co-founder of 88 Chump, a nonprofit social activism organization, and he grew up with George Floyd in Houston. Vaughn, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, everyone.
And I want to start by getting your reaction. Where were you yesterday, and what was your reaction when you heard the jury's verdict?
Yesterday, I was in Lake Charles, Louisiana, where I'm currently at right now. I'm going to be headed to Houston shortly. Mm-hmm. My reaction was I didn't have any reaction, to be honest, because I felt like the criminal justice system and the courts have failed us so many times to convict an officer of a crime of a person of color, whether black or brown. So once the verdict was read, and on all three counts, they found him guilty, I didn't get excited. I didn't jump up or anything. It just showed me that change has come in certain parts of the system. Some individuals stood up proudly for the change, such as the police chief. It was someone else, a high-ranking officer, the little girl who videoed the incident, and several others more. So it showed me that the young Americans are stepping up and not tolerating racism and hatred in America, and that they look at people of color as being equal to them.
And you bring up a point saying that you didn't, it wasn't jubilation that you felt, it was more of a quiet recognition. It seemed just from viewing footage of people, even in Minneapolis, there was not an eruption of joy. There was not a cheering. It was sort of a, it was just sort of a, almost a stunned satisfaction in seeing what, in seeing justice done in this case. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I believe that, first of all, I want to thank the Minnesota Attorney General for stepping up and prosecuting the case, but this is a chess game. Chess has three phases, the beginning, middle, and end. And once Perry was actually, we called him Perry, you guys call him George. Once Perry was actually killed on the pavement in Minnesota, that was the first phase. The second phase was trying to get the court system to, and the Attorney General to file the proper charges against Derek Chauvin, and also make sure that there's no prejudice with it by him being a police officer. So that's the middle phase, not the end phase. It's the sentencing phase. From what I'm getting and what I'm understanding, you know, he can get 12 to 15 years, you know, because they're going to pretty much run out of charges concurrent. So is that just? You know, it's like they say, right, beauty is here in the eye of the beholder. So is that just for the way that Floyd was brutally murdered on the streets? Is that justice? So we can't say that it's accountability, and we see that the state of Minnesota is showing accountability, but it was four other black men in Minnesota who were killed by in the hands of police officers. Nothing has been done concerning that. So for George to come out and go out to make George the poster boy for this and for the world to see it, not just America, it's a beautiful thing, because those jurors weren't biased, they weren't prejudiced. They wanted justice from their eyesight. So that's the beautiful thing. But now the accountability part is set in, but now let's see how the fair and just of the sentencing phase is going to come from the judge himself.
All right, Vaughn, I'm going to hold you right there so we can take a break. We're discussing the guilty verdict in Derek Chauvin's trial in the murder of George Floyd. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial and what it means for race and policing. I'm here with Vaughn Dickerson, a lifelong friend of George Floyd. Now, Vaughn, you mentioned Keith Ellison, the Attorney General in Minnesota, and here he is speaking to the press yesterday.
George Floyd mattered. He was loved by his family and his friends. His death shocked the conscience of our community, our country, the whole world. He was loved by his family and friends. But that isn't why he mattered. He mattered because he was a human being. And there is no way we can turn away from that reality.
So, Vaughn, you are watching, you watch this verdict not only as an activist, but as a lifelong friend of George Floyd. Can you tell us how that felt and knowing George Floyd, what that meant to you?
again, it was bittersweet. You can't replace him. He's not here. He's not with the family. He's not going to see his daughter go to prom. He's not going to see him graduate, things of this nature. And then most importantly, he wasn't able to fulfill what he wanted to fulfill, his God-given dreams of his full talent. So yesterday, again, I was in a somber mood. I wasn't sad or anything, but it was just accountability. It was just a beautiful thing to find the jurors to convict Derek Chauvin. But it was more beautiful watching the news coverage of CNN and other news outlets and just seeing that it wasn't just people of color. It was Caucasians. It was Asian. It was a melting pot. And mm-hmm. when you see Caucasian people throw up the Black Power sign, the Black Fist, saying that they're on board with us, that they're with us, that they are our brothers, they are our sisters, that they are our keepers. And it was a younger generation. It was a beautiful thing. And to see the crowd not going crazy and jumping on top of police cars and things of that nature, which is what most people thought what was going to happen, because this is what has happened in the past. But, you know, history repeats itself if you don't learn from it. So I think that as America as a whole, as a country, they're learning from the mistakes of the criminal justice system, and that Black people are being racially profiled. We are being singled out, and you see it every day. It's happening every day. But the reason why things like this is happening is because there's no accountability. Yesterday showed me one thing, that there is accountability and it is starting. So we can breathe now. But for me, I never stopped breathing. Once my friend was murdered, I was breathing harder.
And you mentioned that now you said that we've moved on to the community stage, and you're talking about that the community now is broader. It's not just Black and brown folks. What would you like to see happen on that community level moving forward?
I would like to see those in power step out. Those at the big corporations, the Exxons, the Shells, the lawyers, the doctors, the people who don't go through the everyday struggle of people in the inner city. Those are the ones who need to step out and say, hey, this is my title, but I am a unity. And in humanity, we all have to stand for what's right. That's going to be the most beautiful thing that we see, when you can see judges, doctors, police officers, and chiefs take off their badges and uniform and get unified with the community, that we all stand together. And this is what's going to make the place a better place to live. Like they were saying that, I heard the lady earlier speaking to the reporter, and she was saying that crime rate has risen. It was due to the pandemic. Now crime rate has risen because it's due to the inner city people struggling. They don't have the means to fit their needs. So when you don't have the means to fit your needs, you'll go by and do anything to try to feed your family or your daughter or whatever. So that's why crime has risen, because we're not playing on a level playing field financially. See, it's a lot of aspects that has to go into this equation of what we're dealing with. If the little girl doesn't video that, Derek Chauvin will be getting off. It's no doubt about it. If it's not video and the world don't actually see a man die and beg for his life on national TV, it wouldn't have never happened. So it's still a lot of work that has and needs to be done here in America.
And that girl, Darnella Frazier, certainly made the difference in this case by videotaping that incident. Vaughn Dickerson, co-founder of 88 Chump, a nonprofit social activism organization, and George Floyd's friend. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you guys very much for listening. And thank you for just having me aboard.
Now joining us from St. Louis is Heather Taylor. She's the Deputy Director of Public Safety in St. Louis. She was appointed by Mayor Tashara Jones, the first Black woman mayor of St. Louis, who was just sworn in yesterday. Heather Taylor is also the former president of the Ethical Society of Police, which represents many Black officers in the St. Louis region, and a former night watch homicide sergeant with the St. Louis Metro Police Department. Heather, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Kim.
And also joining us is Paige Fernandez, and she's joining us from Philadelphia. She's the policing policy advisor for the ACLU. Paige, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Kim.
So, Heather, I want to start with you. What was the reaction in St. Louis, a place where the region knows well police violence and protests? What was the reaction there yesterday to the verdict?
It was a moment, brief moment of joy, a brief reprieve from what we've normally seen with officers being found not guilty.
And what message do you think this sends to police departments across the country about the use of force?
That, you know, law enforcement will be held accountable, that we're not above the law. That hopefully it sends the message that you have to do better with who you're hiring. We can't continue to hire these monsters and expect them not to behave like that. And hopefully it sends that message that until police departments correct these wrongs, the community is never going to accept us in these communities.
And can you tell our listeners what you see your role is now in St. Louis, in this new role that you have? What will be your focus in working with the police department in light of what we've seen yesterday?
So Mayor Tishara Jones put me in this position. Everyone knows that I'm probably one of the most vocal people in the nation about police corruption as an officer, when I was an officer, and as a former officer. My role is to have accountability. I don't only have law enforcement, the police department. I have Department of Corrections, and our Department of Corrections has made national news. My job is to further the plans of our mayor, Tishara Jones. She has a plan that's about our community and about bringing better resources and reallocating resources to where they're needed, so that when you need someone that has a mental health concern, that you're not sending someone with a gun and a badge that has no training with dealing with someone in the middle of a mental health crisis. So it's a lot. We have a lot of work to do here, and that is my role. Some people won't like it, but who cares about that? You know, I have a job to do, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it fairly, and I'm happy to be here.
And Paige Fernandez, from your view from the ACLU, what changes did the protests that we saw over last summer after George Floyd's killing, what changes were catalyzed based on that from your viewpoint?
I think there were a few changes that we saw. I think there was a heavy emphasis across the country, especially from elected officials, on the idea of accountability and what happens after the fact, after harm is committed. So we saw a lot of bills being passed to hold officers accountable after they harm community members, after they engage in misconduct. But on the local level, on the municipal level, we saw this re-examining of public safety. Really, what does it mean to be safe? And how do we invest in life-affirming solutions and programs that are community-based and community-led, that do not rely on law enforcement and our punitive criminal legal system? And so we've seen changes of removing police from traffic enforcement, removing police from responding to mental health crises, and divesting from police departments by the millions of dollars.
And Heather, what is your reaction to that? I mean, a lot of people want to see police less engaged, want to see police funding for police reduced, and some even want to see the abolition of police in certain places where there are real problems. How do you work from within the system to bring that change?
You have to understand that law enforcement has... We have to address why we have pretextual stops. We have to do away with certain things that are of a priority, because traffic stops often lead to death. We have to look at it as a whole, because we cannot forget victims of violent crime. When someone is a domestic violence victim, when they're a victim of a sexual assault, when they're a victim of a homicide, when we talk about defunding, we have to give that meaning, more meaning than just the word. We have to give it more meaning. What are we doing? Are we going to reallocate police resources towards mental health? We need it. We have very little mental health resources in our city. We have very little resources for victims of domestic violence. So when we talk about reallocating, my word for it, for defund is reallocating. So we're reallocating these resources. We're streamlining them to people who need them instead of going through law enforcement, who most times ill-prepared and ill-trained to go to the right people at the right moment.
Yesterday, President Biden addressed the nation after the verdict. Here's what he said last night.
No one should be above the law. And today's verdict sends that message. But it's not enough. We can't stop here. In order to deliver real change and reform, we can and we must do more to reduce the likelihood that tragedies like this will ever happen and occur again.
Paige, I want to bring you into the points that Heather was making just now about what the changes might look like. Is it structural within the police department in terms of the use of body cameras or other things? Is it cultural in the police culture that really focuses on things like compliance as opposed to de-escalation? What do you see? What are the key points that need to be addressed now?
I think right now is a critical moment for us to be moving away from procedural justice reforms, which really try to seek to repair harms or to hold people accountable after the fact through our criminal legal system, is really incredibly reliant on our criminal legal system. And I think we need to focus our energy instead on three things. The first is reducing the role of police. So eliminating behavior that is subject to policing and punishment and narrowing specific police responsibilities. I think this is incredibly important as we acknowledge that police play an outsized role in this country and also acknowledge where police come from. I think it's really important in this moment to acknowledge that police were designed in this country to oppress and harm and kill Black people. They were developed from slave patrols. So we really need to re-examine the role of police. We also need to reduce the resources of police, which means divesting from police budgets for a radically smaller, demilitarized police force and reinvesting those funds in other community and safety priorities and life-affirming solutions. And then finally is reducing the power of police. So eliminating the architecture of impunity that has enabled unchecked police power to go on in this country.
Heather, what do you say to that about limiting the role that police plays? And I will just give you a little anecdote from me. During the summer, there was somebody who would rev his car at 5 a.m. every morning in a really loud way in my neighborhood. And I went to the website of my local community where I lived then to see how to, you know, place a noise complaint and what civil agency would handle that. And it was the police. So I didn't call them because I knew that this was a man of color and I didn't want to initiate that interaction. How do you remove police from things like, you know, noise complaints, where you really don't need an armed person to confront someone in that situation?
So what you have to do is that a lot of times vehicles are stopped for parking, for things that could be written as a parking violation. We have vehicles that are stopped for bad plates, and we're policing poverty a lot of times. And when you, but you also have to take into account the people who live there, like you. You lived in a neighborhood, Kim, where you had someone that was revving their vehicle, and it was loud. It was, you know, at certain times of night and the day, and it was interrupting. So your city government has to be aligned to start taking away those authorities from the police department. So that means that you send it to your street department. Or some entity that's outside of public safety that can contact him, or your crisis resource centers where you literally have people who are designed to deal with that. They're the middle. They do mediation between community members where you let the community work it out, where you can sit down if you want to with that gentleman there, and you two collectively with mediation come to a conclusion instead of sending police there. So we have to get towards all of those things. We have to start removing some of the authority from law enforcement, because we see what law enforcement does a lot of times. And I'm not saying all, because I was in this field. But I do also understand that we have to reinvest money. We have to divest money from law enforcement into things where we are actually needed in our community. We have to streamline things. It doesn't mean that people aren't going to have law enforcement when they're a victim of a violent crime. You must have that. You got to have that. But there are other things like this call you're talking about with a gentleman revving his engine. Why don't we have mediation centers? We have a crisis resource center in St. Louis, and they're for that very reason. But it's imperative that local governments get that information out to our community, that they know they have alternatives to 911.
All right. We're discussing what the guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial means for the future of race, accountability, and policing. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This Thursday, Earth Day, we'll be talking about climate change. Specifically, we'll talk about why it's so hard for many people to engage, to change their behaviors. We know it's a threat, and we hear the dire warnings. We care. Yet still many of us can't seem to motivate to take action. Why is it so hard? What feelings do you experience when you think about climate change? Grief? Hopelessness? Helplessness? In what ways are you working to overcome the urge to look away, to worry about it later, to kick the can down the road? Or maybe you are motivated. You are out there pushing for change, helping others to wake up and act. We want to hear your story. Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And now we're discussing the impact of the conclusion of the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd and what it means for police reform. We're here with Heather Taylor, Deputy Director of Public Safety in St. Louis, and Paige Fernandez, Policing Policy Advisor for the ACLU. Now, Heather, you talked a little bit about the fact that you came from law enforcement, but you also have experience with law enforcement in your own family. Can you tell us about that?
My aunt was unfortunately murdered by Deputy Marshall in 1993. He ended up serving 3 years for her murder, and it's spearheaded my goals to go into law enforcement. Coming from a mostly naive, you're young, you believe you can change the world. Came into law enforcement from the beginning, fighting from the pretty much the police academy until I left out the door, just fighting for people like her who are marginalized, who are mistreated by law enforcement and or anyone. You know, I became a homicide detective because I wanted to help victims of homicide and their families receive justice. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how do these experiences color how you are doing your job now?
Every day. Every day. My cousin's birthday was Monday, and her mom is no longer here to celebrate that birthday with her. And we had, you know, our family was tight and small, and we lost a big part of that. And that's what happens to families. You know, my story is not unique. And that's the problem with law enforcement. There are other families, George Floyd's family, who's lost someone at the hands of murder in law enforcement. And it shapes me every day. It's with me. There isn't that trauma is never you find ways to cope with it, but it's never not there.
And Paige, what are some of the impediments as you see them to change? What are some of the barriers? Is it legislatures that won't act? Is it the difficulty in changing police culture? Is it police unions? What are the barriers as you see them?
I think there are many barriers. I think a barrier that I'm seeing right now that I'm a little bit scared of is the idea of complacency, that we got this verdict. And so, you know, accountability has been served and the system is working the way it's supposed to work. But I think it's critical that we understand, in my opinion, that Chauvin was a sacrificial lamb for police officers and police departments across this country. Chauvin is only the eighth officer convicted of murder since 2005 of over 16,000 police killings. And so while I recognize the relief and the satisfaction that comes from the verdict, I think it's critical people don't slide into complacency now. I also see police unions as a huge barrier, and elected officials as a barrier as well. I think the public is much more willing to implement transformational change than our elected officials are, where they have been focused so much on what happens on the back end. People on the ground are demanding, let's stop this from the beginning. Let's ensure police are not coming into contact with community members so they cannot kill community members. Whereas we see a lot of elected officials on the federal and state level saying, well, afterwards, we'll hold them accountable, and that should deter their actions. But we know that is untrue. Dante Wright was killed only 10 miles away from where the Chauvin trial was taking place. That didn't deter Kimberly Porter's actions.
And Heather, I want to talk a little bit more about pushback from within the police department. I mean, we saw in the coverage yesterday, police officers, white officers in Columbus, yelling Blue Lives Matter at Black protesters last night. I got messages from people saying that the terrorists, referring to the Black Lives Matter movement, won, and now nobody's going to want to be a police officer. You've talked about your own experiences with racism from other officers. How do you see that playing a role as we continue this discussion about bringing change and finding a way to have more justice?
I don't believe that racism is going to leave law enforcement because we're a microcosm of society. And racism is not for African Americans to change. We can't change that. What we can do when it comes to law enforcement, it is having more diversity when it comes to hiring. I really believe in that. Better background checks of potential hires who are hired. Because a lot of times there's always been red flags. You also have to have protections in place, whistleblower protections. When I came out and said that I felt Jason Stockley was guilty of murder, after seeing all of this video evidence and knowing that his fingerprints were on the gun that killed Anthony Lamar Smith, and, you know, I received death threats as an officer. I'm a police officer, and these threats came from other law enforcement. And you don't have internally the options of protected status and officers knowing of getting whistleblower protections. And I also agree that police unions are a major problem internally. They build the culture that exists. And if we don't reel in police unions, ours in particular is one of the most, one of ours is one of the most egregious. And these police unions need to understand that you can say that an officer is guilty of a crime. What prevents you from saying that you believe that their actions were wrong? Nothing prevents us from saying that. I was a police association president. I said it. I said it with black officers and white officers. Nothing prevents that. And until we get police unions and police officers and changing the culture, we're always going to have racism. We're always going to have homophobia. We're always going to have the next Derek Chauvin. They're waiting. If we just don't know about them already.
And Heather, we talk a lot about reforms. We've talked a lot about federal legislation, like the George Floyd Policing Act. But policing ultimately is very local, right? So how do, if people are listening from police departments across the country at a local level, whether in a big city like yours or in a small community, what changes should they be considering making right now, this morning, beginning to make mm-hmm. as a result of yesterday?
I think St. Louis is unique. We have a African-American, our first African-American mayor, Tashara Jones, who is proactive in our community. She's about accountability with law enforcement and everyone. You decide who your next mayor is going to be 3 years from when that term is over. You know, you decide that. And locally, you have the ability to make more substantial change than you do on a national scale because you control local budgets. You are the ones that are voting in politicians who are going to control the police budget. And you have more say-so in the city of St. Louis. Honestly, without our activists and our protest communities, I don't know where I would be. As far as feeling safe, just feeling safe and becoming more aware of legislation and in local terms, because most things are controlled on the local level. Local government has to hold local police departments accountable, and you have to elect people in those local government positions that are willing to do it. And St. Louis is lucky. Right now we have a mayor who was elected on a platform that was about police reform in St. Louis City, of all places. Mm-hmm. And it's important who you vote for in to get in these positions to change.
We asked our listeners what their reaction was to the verdict yesterday, and here are some of the reactions that we heard on Twitter. One listener said, "The case was clear. It was presented with all the care every human being, every life lost to violence and injustice deserves. The jury delivered a fair and true verdict. Now we have a precedent, a template to follow, knowledge where the leadership and the training fall short. Time to carry that forward." Another listener said, "It's depressing that there was any question about what the verdict might be, even when there were so many recordings of Mr. Floyd's murder, but it's finally some accountability. We have to use it to propel ourselves forward in making sure all Americans have true freedom." Paige, you said you were afraid of complacency. Is there any hope that the verdict may, at least for now, do what these listeners are hoping, which is propel people forward to seek out solutions to this kind of violence?
I really do hope that it does propel people. And I'm really glad that Heather brought up the importance of local politics and doing work in your community, because that is where so much of the power we hold is. And that's where we can really implement effective and important changes. I think this is an opportunity to propel people. I encourage people to think bigger than our criminal legal system, though. This verdict is a punitive consequence for one individual. There is relief and punishment, but there is not justice. And in order to seek justice, we have to go further. And I do want to say, I mean, there are Black-led grassroots organizations, Black organizers and advocates across the country who are not backing down from this fight. Black Visions Collective and Reclaim the Block in Minneapolis and a bunch of other grassroots organizations in Minneapolis are working to put a measure on the ballot in November that would create an entirely new department of community safety and violence prevention that is focused on a holistic public health approach to safety. And so there is so much going on. And really, I encourage people to get connected to the ground, get connected to local politics, join grassroots organizations, and use this momentum to propel bolder and bigger changes in the future.
Heather, one thing that really struck me in the trial was this idea about compliance and how that seemed to be valued over the de-escalation. And it also served as a defense for Derek Chauvin's defense team, saying, well, if only George Floyd had complied, then this wouldn't have happened. Is that a problem within policing, as you see it, this focus that no matter what, no matter the reason for the stop, the ultimate goal is for people to comply with police?
It doesn't matter if you comply. We have seen it over and over again that black and brown people have been murdered. And compliance, it would be great if in a perfect world that when police are asking you to do something, that you comply. But people forget where we come from, especially as African Americans. I grew up in the inner city. I grew up around police officers that were corrupt, and we ran from the police. Why would we stay there and comply when the risk was so great for us? That trauma is real for us. So when you talk about Dante Wright and comply, well, Philando Castile. When we comply, mm-hmm. we're still killed. So our perspective with it is very different in marginalized communities. It's very different from that of law enforcement and that of other communities that don't have these daily fears. When you see police, it's anxiety. It's trauma being pulled over. I was a law enforcement officer. When I was pulled over by police, I found myself sweating. I didn't do anything wrong, and I'm a law enforcement officer. We have law enforcement officers right here. Luther Hall was brutally beaten by four white officers. We have, he was complying. You have Milton Green, who was shot by another white officer. So when you talk about compliance, that doesn't mean you're going to be safe. That's our reality, and it's on law enforcement to change that.
And we have just over a minute left, and it's clearly not enough time, Heather. But also in this trial was really clear that this idea that Black Americans, particularly Black men, are seen as threats. This idea that George Floyd, as the defense argued, was still a threat when he was unconscious. How do we change that?
And that is, again, my belief is that us as African Americans, I can't change that perspective. I can't. What I can do is that I can go out and vote. I can realize that I have say-so in local government, where it starts, because there was likely some incident that happened with Derek Chauvin that he should have been fired for on the local level, having your civilian oversight boards and things like that. That's what I feel I have control over. I can't control someone's racism. I can't control when a police department decides to hire a monster. How I can do it is being involved locally, getting active, and forcing elected officials to do what they're supposed to do and to protect everyone, not just the majority.
Okay. Heather Taylor is Deputy Director of Public Safety in St. Louis. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Paige Fernandez is Policing Policy Advisor for the ACLU. Thank you, Paige.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.